This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Mosquito Land by David Arnold. Read for you by Phoebe Stroll. Jackson, Mississippi. 947 miles to go. Chapter 1. A thing's not a thing until you say it out loud. I am Mary Iris Malone. And I am not okay. Chapter 2. The Uncomfortable Nearness of Strangers. September 1, afternoon. Dear Isabel, as a member of the family, you have a right to know what's going on. Dad agrees, but says I should avoid topics of substance and despair. When I asked how he proposed I do this, seeing as our family is prone to substantial desperation, he rolled his eyes and flared his nostrils like he does. The thing is, I'm incapable of fluff. So here goes. The straight dope, Mim style. Filled to the brim with topics of substance and despair. Just over a month ago, I moved from the greener pastures of Ashland, Ohio, to the dried-up wastelands of Jackson, Mississippi, with Dad and Kathy. During that time, it's possible I've gotten into some trouble at my new school. Not trouble with a capital T, you understand, but this is a subtle distinction for adults once they're determined to ruin a kid's youth. My new principal is just such a man. He scheduled a conference for 10 a.m., in which the malfeasance of Mim Malone would be the only point of order. Kathy switched her day shift at Denny's so she could join Dad as a parental representative. I was in Algebra 2 watching Mr. Harrow carry on a romantic relationship with his polynomials when my name echoed down the coral-painted hallways. Mim Malone, please report to Principal Schwartz's office. Mim Malone to the principal's office. Suffice it to say, I didn't want to go, but the loudspeaker summoned, and the student responded, and 'twas always thus. The foyer leading into the principal's office was dank, a suffocating decor of rusty maroons and browns. Inspirational posters were plastered around the room, boasting one-word encouragements and eagles soaring over purple mountain majesties. I threw up a little, swallowed it back down. "You can go on back," said a secretary without looking up. "They're expecting you." Beyond the secretary's desk, Principal Schwartz's heavy oak door was cracked open an inch. Nearing it, I heard low voices on the other side. "What's her mother's name again?" asked Schwartz, his timbre muffled by that lustrous 70s mustache, a holdover from the glory days, no doubt. "Eve," said Dad. Schwartz. "Right, right. What a shame. Well, I hope Mim is grateful for your involvement, Kathy. Heaven knows she needs a mother figure right now." Kathy. "We all just want Eve to get better, you know? And she will. She'll beat this disease. Eve's a fighter." Just outside the door, I stood frozen, inside and out. "Disease?" Schwartz. Sigh. "Does Mim know?" Dad. Different kind of sigh. "No, the time just doesn't seem right. New school, new friends, lots of new developments, as you can see." Schwartz. Chuckle. "Quite. Well, hopefully things will come together for Eve in... Where did you say she was?" Dad. "Cleveland. And thank you. We're hoping for the best." Every great character is, be it on page or screen, is multidimensional. The good guys aren't all good, the bad guys aren't all bad, and any character wholly one or the other shouldn't exist at all. Remember this when I describe the antics that follow, for though I am not a villain, I am not immune to villainy. Our heroine turns from the oak door, calmly exits the office, the school, the grounds. She walks in a daze, trying to put the pieces together. Across the football field, athletic meatheads sneer, but she hears them not. Her trusty Goodwill shoes carry her down the crumbling sidewalk while she considers the three-week drought of letters and phone calls from her mother. Our heroine takes the shortcut behind the taco hole, ignoring its beefy bouquet. She walks the lonely streets of her new neighborhood, rounds the skyscraping oak, and pauses for a moment in the shade of her new residence. She checks the mailbox, empty, as always. Pulling out her phone, she dials her mother's number for the 100th time. Hears the same robotic lady for the 100th time. Is disheartened for the 100th time. "We're sorry, this number has been disconnected." She shuts her phone and looks up at this new house. A house bought for the low, low price of everything she'd ever known to be true. "Glass and concrete and stone," she whispers, the chorus of one of her favorite songs. She smiles, pulls her hair back into a ponytail, and finishes the lyric. "It is just a house, not a home." Bursting through the front door, our heroine takes the steps three at a time. She ignores the new house smell, a strange combination of sanitizer, tacos, and pig-headed denial, and sprints to her bedroom. Here, she repacks her trusty JanSport backpack with overnight provisions, a bottle of water, toiletries, extra clothes, meds, war paint, makeup remover, and a bag of potato chips. She dashes into her father and stepmother's bedroom and drops to her knees in front of the feminine dresser. Our heroine reaches behind a neatly folded stack of Spanx in the bottom drawer and retrieves a coffee can labeled Hills Brothers Original Blend. Popping the cap, she removes a thick wad of bills and counts by Andrew Jackson's to $880. Her evil stepmother had overestimated the secrecy of this hiding spot, for our heroine sees all. Adding the can of cash to her backpack, she bolts from her house not a home, jogs a half mile to the bus stop, and catches a metro line to the Jackson Greyhound Terminal. She's known the where for a while now. Cleveland, Ohio, 947 miles away. But until today, she wasn't sure of the how or when. The how, a bus. The when, pronto, post-haste, lickety-split. And scene. But you're a true Malone, and as such, this won't be enough for you. You'll need more than just where's, when's, and how's. You'll need why's. You'll think, why wouldn't our heroine just insert brilliant solution here? The truth is, reasons are hard. I'm standing on a whole stack of them right now with barely a notion of how I got up here. So maybe that's what this will be, is my book of reasons. I'll explain the whys behind my what's, and you can see for yourself how my reasons stack up. Consider that little clandestine convo between Dad, Kathy, and Schwartz reason number one. It's a long way to Cleveland, so I'll try and space the rest out, but for now, know this. My reasons may be hard, but my objectives are quite simple. Get to Cleveland. Get to Mom. I salute myself. I accept my mission. Signing off, Mary Iris Malone. Mother-effing mother-saver. Retracing the stick figure on the front of this journal makes little difference. Stick figures are eternally anemic. I pull my dark hair across one shoulder, slump my forehead against the window, and marvel at the outside world. Before Mississippi had her devilish way, my marvelings were wondrously unique. Recently they've become, I don't know what, middling, tragically mediocre. To top it off, a rain of biblical proportions is absolutely punishing the earth right now, and I can't help feeling it deserves it. Stuffing my journal in my backpack, I grab my bottle of Abilitol. Tip, swallow, repeat daily. This is the habit, and habit is king, so says Dad. I swallow the pill, then shove the bottle back in my bag with attitude. Also part of the habit. So says I.
The hell are you doing in here, Missy?
I see the tuft first, a tall poke of hair towering over the front two seats. It's dripping wet and crooked like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. The man, a Greyhound employee named Carl, according to the damp patch on his button-down, is huge, lumbering even. Still eyeballing me, he pulls a burrito out of nowhere, unwraps it, digs in. Enchanté, Carl. This is the bus to Cleveland, right? I rummage around in my bag. I have a ticket.
Missy, he says, his mouth full. You could have Wonky's golden fucking ticket for all I care. We ain't started boarding yet.
In my head, 1,000 tiny mims shoot flaming arrows at Carl, burning his hair to the ground in a glorious blaze of tuft. Before one of these metaphysical mims gets me into trouble, I hear my mother's voice in my ear, echoing a toll, the chime of my childhood. Kill him with kindness, Mary. Absolutely murder him with it. I throw on a girlish smile in my mother's British accent.
Blimey, that's a lovely uniform, chap. Really accentuates your pectorals.
The leaning tower of tuft calmly chews his burrito, turns, points to the open door. I throw on my backpack and ease down the aisle.
Seriously, old chap, just dynamite pecs.
I'm out the door and into the squall before he can respond. I don't suppose that's what Mom would have meant by murdering with kindness, but honestly, just then, that was the only me I could be. Flipping my hoodie over my head, I cross the station lot toward an awning, hopping a 6 rising puddles. Underneath the canopy, 7 or 8 people stand shoulder to shoulder, glancing at watches, rereading papers, anything to avoid acknowledging the uncomfortable nearness of strangers. I squeeze in next to a middle-aged man in a poncho and watch the water pour over the edge of the awning like a paper-thin waterfall.
Is that you?
Says Poncho Man, inches away. Please don't let him be talking to me. Please don't let him be talking to me.
Excuse me, he says, nudging my JanSport. I think your backpack is singing.
I sling my bag around and pull out my cell. The dulcet tones of Stevie Wonder's I Just Called to Say I Love You echo off the walls of our little canvas and water prison. Stevie only croons when Kathy calls, altogether negating the sentiment of the lyrics.
That's sweet, says Poncho Man. Your boyfriend?
Stepmom, I whisper, staring at her name on the LCD screen. Kathy preloaded the song to be her special ring. I've been meaning to change it to something more appropriate, like Darth Vader's Imperial March, or that robotic voice that just yells, "Warning! Warning!" over and over again.
You guys must be close.
Singing phone in hand, I turn to face this guy.
What? The song! Are you and your stepmother close?
Oh, yeah, sure, I say, summoning every sarcastic bone in my body. Leaving the phone unanswered, I toss it in my bag.
We're tight.
He nods, smiling from ear to ear.
That's terrific.
I say nothing. My quota for conversations with a stranger has officially been met. For the decade.
So where are you headed, hon?
He asks. Well, that's that. I take a deep breath, step through the mini waterfall and into the rain. It's still falling in sheets, but I don't mind. It's the first rain of autumn, my favorite of the year. And maybe it's this, or the adrenaline of my day's decisions, but I'm feeling reckless. Or honest, maybe. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. Turning toward Poncho Man, I notice his eyes are wet and shiny. But it's not from crying or the rain. It's something else entirely. And for a split second, I have the peculiar sensation that everyone and everything around us has dissolved. It's just the two of us, cursed to face one another amid the ravenous elements of this bus station for all of forever.
You know, I yell over the rain, breaking the curse. I'm 16!
The other people under the awning are staring now, unable to ignore the uncomfortable nearness any longer.
Okay.
He says, nodding, still smiling with those glassy eyes. I push a clump of sopping hair out of my face and pull the drawstrings of my hoodie tight around my head.
You really shouldn't talk to young girls at bus stations. It's just creepy, man.
Soaked to the bone, pondering the madness of the world, I stomp through puddles to the doors of the Jackson Greyhound station. Next to gate C, a short man in a tweed hat hands me a flyer.
Labor Day special, $4.50 General Tso chicken. Why you pay more? Drop by. We famous.
The flyer is a domino. The first, tipping over a row of memories. A blank fortune knocks over Labor Day traditions, knocks over Elvis, knocks over fireworks, knocks over the way things used to be, knocks over, knocks over. From 1,000 miles away, I feel my mother needing me. This is a thing that I know, and I know it harder, stronger, fuller than I've ever known any other thing. 4 days until Labor Day, 96 hours. I can't be late.
Chapter 3. Northbound Greyhound. September 1. Afternoon. Dear Isabel. So I'm bored. On a bus. Stuck next to an old lady who keeps leaning over like she wants to start up a conversation. To maintain sanity, I shall write. Labor Day is reason number 2. Now, I know what you're thinking. Really, Mim? Labor Day? And rightfully so. What's so special about the first Monday of September that the government would shut down the country in its honor? Honestly, if it weren't for school closings and extended happy hours, I'm not sure anyone would know it exists. But I would. One Labor Day, 6 or 7 years ago, Mom stood up in the middle of dinner and asked if I'd like to go for a walk. Dad kept his head down, toying with the food on his plate. "Evie," he whispered without looking up. I remember laughing because it looked like he was giving his food a name. Mom said something about the digestive benefits of exercise after eating, grabbed my hand, and together we walked out the door, down the hushed streets of our subdivision. We laughed and talked and laughed some more. I loved it when she was like that. All young and fun, and eager to keep being young and fun. And it didn't matter what happened the day before or the day after. All that mattered was the young, fun now. Such a rare thing. Anyway, that's when we found it. Or rather, them. Our people. They lived on Utopia Court, if you can believe it. A little cul-de-sac tucked in the back of the neighborhood. When we turned the corner, it was like stepping through Alice's looking glass, only instead of the Jabberwock and a Red Queen, we found revolutionaries and idealists. People who damned the man. People who refused to bow to suburban mediocrity. While the rest of the neighborhood watched TV or played video games, that little cul-de-sac set off explosions for the ages. They understood the young, fun now. Every Labor Day, Mom and I came back for more. We took part in their pig roasts, lemonade stands, and beer buckets, their loud stereos and rambunctious kids, their flag wavings and fireworks and food gorgings. We did so with gumption and hunger and thirst, knowing full well it would be another 364 days before those offerings came back around. That first year, we went back for Memorial Day. Bupkis. Nothing. Like an empty baseball stadium. Same with 4th of July. I guess Utopia Court was more like Narnia than the Looking Glass in that respect. It was never where, or rather when, you thought it would be. Bottom line, in the face of suburban mediocrity, Utopia Court provided an honest-to-God mutiny, and we loved every mutinous minute. So there's the setup. Now for the teardown. Last year, just as the fireworks were picking up steam, Mom set down her beer and began saying thank yous and good nights. Something was wrong. We'd never left so early. But I didn't argue. What mattered to her mattered to me. Reluctantly, I followed her back to the other side of the looking glass. We admired the fireworks from a distance, holding hands as we walked. Yes, I held hands with my mother, but then nothing about our relationship has ever been traditional. Suddenly, Mom stopped dead in her tracks. This image of my mother's silhouette against a black sky backdrop as majestic fires exploded all around is a memory I have tucked in my back pocket, one I can pull out and examine at will, to remember her like that forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Infinite forevers. Mary, she whispered. She wasn't looking at me, and I could tell her mind was somewhere I could never be. I waited for whatever it was Mom wanted to say, because that's how it used to be with us. There was no need for prodding. For a few minutes, we stood there on the quiet sidewalk, stuck between mutiny and mediocrity. As the distant fireworks dwindled, our sidewalk became darker, as if Utopia's pyrotechnics had been the city's only source of light. Just then, Mom let go of my hand and turned. "I was lovely once," she whispered, "but he never loved me once." Her tone was familiar, like the lyric of some dark-eyed youth singing tragic cliches. But Mom was no youth, and this was no cliche. "Who?" I said softly. "Dad?" She never answered. Eventually, she began walking toward our house, toward mediocrity, away from the glorious mutiny. I followed her the rest of the way in silence. I remember this like it was yesterday. I remember because it was the last time we held hands. Signing off, Mary Iris Malone, Mutineer Extraordinaire.
"Now those are some interesting shoes. Where does a person get shoes like that?"
I guess I've held the old lady off for as long as possible. "Goodwill," I say, stuffing my journal in my backpack.
"Which one?"
"I don't really remember."
Very strappy, aren't they? And colorful."
The old lady is right. Only the 80s, with its fuchsia-infused electropop, could have produced high-top footwear of such dazzling flamboyance. 4 Velcro straps apiece, just in case. There's a whole platoon of unworn sneakers in my closet at home, Kathy's attempts to replace more pieces of my old life. "My stepmother hates them," I say, leaning back in my seat. The old woman wrinkles her forehead, leans over for a better look.
"Well, I'm quite taken with them. They've got pizzazz, don't you know?"
"Thanks," I say, smiling. "Who says pizzazz?" I look down at her white leather walking shoes, complete with 3-inch soles and a wide Velcro band.
"Yours are cool, too."
What starts as a chuckle ends in a deep, hearty laugh.
"Oh, yes," she says, lifting both feet off the ground. "Très chic, no?"
I'll admit, initially, I'd been wary of sitting next to an old lady. The beehive hairdos, the knit turtlenecks, the smell of onion soup, and imminent death. But as the bus had been packed, I'd had very limited options when it came to a seatmate. It was either the old lady, the glassy-eyed poncho man, or a 300-pound Jabba the Hutt look-alike. So I sat. Beehive hair? Check. Knit turtleneck? Check. Nothing to rile the geriatric Gestapo. But her smell. I've been trying to place it ever since I sat down. It is decidedly un-geriatric. It's like potpourri, maybe. Abandoned attics, handmade quilts. Fucking fresh-baked cookies with a hint of cinnamon. That's it exactly. God, I love cinnamon. The old lady shifts in her seat, accidentally dropping her purse to the floor. In her lap, I see a wooden container no larger than a shoebox. It has a deep red hue and a brass lock, but what stands out most is the way her left hand is holding it, white-knuckled and for dear life. I pick up her purse and hand it to her. Blushing, she replaces it on top of the wooden box.
"Thank you," she says, offering a handshake. "I'm Arlene, by the way."
Her crooked fingers point in all directions, withering under a spiderweb of bulging veins and rusty rings. Not surprisingly, her hand is soft in mine. Surprisingly, it is quite pleasant. "I'm Mim." She raises the same hand to adjust her beehive.
"What an interesting name, Mim. Almost as interesting as those shoes."
I smile politely. "It's an acronym, actually."
"A what?"
"My real name is Mary Iris Malone. MIM is just an acronym, but when I was younger, I thought it was acroname, which made total sense.
Acroname, how clever, says Arlene.
Mary was my grandmother's name.
It's quite lovely.
I shrug. I guess. It doesn't really
match the shoes,
she says, nudging me in the ribs. Arlene is turning out to be a surprise a minute, with her Velcro shoes and phraseology, all pizzazz and très chic, non? I wonder if she'd be so likable if I unloaded on her. Just told her everything, even the breaking news. I could do it, too. Those bright blue batty eyes are just begging for it.
So, what's in Cleveland? She asks, pointing to my backpack.
The corner of an envelope is sticking out of a side pocket, its return address clearly visible. Eve Durham, P.O. Box 449, Cleveland, Ohio, 44103. I tuck the envelope away.
Nothing. My uncle?
Oh? Says Arlene, raising her eyebrows.
What?
I was just thinking. Eve is an interesting name for a man. Like a priest during confession, Arlene doesn't meet my eyes. She folds her hands across the purse in her lap, looks straight ahead, and waits for me to tell the truth. We've only just met, but things like time hardly matter when dealing with a familiar spirit. I turn, look out the window as the dense forest zooms by in a blur, a thousand trees becoming one. My parents got divorced 3 months ago, I say, just loud enough for her to hear over the hum of the engine. Dad found a replacement at Denny's.
The restaurant?
I know, right? Most people find breakfast. Arlene doesn't laugh at my joke, which makes me like her even more. Some jokes aren't meant to be funny. The wedding was 6 weeks ago. They're married now. My chest tightens at the sound of my own words. It's the first time I've said it out loud. Eve is my mother. She lives in Cleveland. I feel Arlene's gentle touch on my back, and I'm afraid of what's coming. The catchphrase monologue, the sermon of encouragement imploring bravery in the face of a crumbling American family. It's all in the manual. Adults just can't help themselves when it comes to words of wisdom.
Is he a good man?
She asks. Arlene, it would seem, has not read the manual.
Who? Your father, dear.
Through the window I see the ocean of trees, now in slow motion, each trunk an anchor, each treetop a rolling wave, a thousand coiling branches, leaves, sharp pine needles. My own reflection in the window is ghost-like, translucent. I am part of this sea of trees, this landscape blurred. All my sharp edges, I whisper. Arlene says something, but it's muffled, as if from an adjacent room. The hum of the bus dissolves, too. Everything is quiet. I hear only my breath, my heartbeat, the internal factory of Mim Malone. I am 6, reading on the floor of our living room in Ashland. Aunt Isabel, visiting from Boston, is sitting at my father's old roll top, writing a letter. Dad pokes his head in the room.
Iz, I need my desk back. You done?
Aunt Isabel doesn't stop scribbling.
I look like I'm done, Barrett?
Dad rolls his eyes, flares his nostrils.
What's a Barrett?
I ask, looking over my book. Aunt Isabel smiles, her head still bent over her letters.
That is, she says, pointing to my dad.
I look at him quizzically.
I thought your name was Barry?
Aunt Isabel shakes her head.
You thought wrong, little lamb.
I love all her nicknames, but Dad is not amused.
You writing a novel there, Iz?
She doesn't answer.
Isabel, I'm talking to you.
No, you're not, she says. You're making fun of me. Dad sighs, mutters something about the futility of correspondence, leaves the room. I go back to my book for a few minutes before asking,
Who are you writing to, Aunt Isabel?
My doctor, she says. Then, setting her pencil down, she turns to me. Writing sort of rounds off the sharp edges of my brain, you know? I nod, but I don't know. With Aunt Iz, I rarely do. Tell you what, she says. When I go back to Boston, you write to me. You'll see what I mean. I consider this for a moment. Do I have sharp edges too, Aunt Iz? She smiles and laughs, and I don't know why. Maybe, little lamb. Either way, you should write. It's better than succumbing to the madness of the world. Here she pauses, glances at the door where Dad had just been standing. And cheaper than pills. Sound returns. The steady hum of the bus engine, and Arlene's voice, warm and wet. Are you all right, Mim? I keep my good eye on the passing landscape. We used to make waffles, I say. A brief pause. Waffles, dear? Every Saturday. Dad mixed and whisked while I sat on a wobbly stool and smiled. Then I poured the mix into the waffle maker and... Another pause. Yes, says Arlene. What? You stopped in the middle of a sentence, dear. Aunt Isabel's last line echoes in my head. Cheaper than pills, ills, ills, ills. I turn, set my jaw, and look Arlene squarely in the eyes. I choose my words carefully, devoting attention to each syllable. I think my dad is a good man who has succumbed to the madness of the world. At first, Arlene doesn't respond. She looks concerned, actually, though I can't be sure if it's due to my answer or my behavior over the last few minutes. Then, her eyes flash, and she nods. So many do, my dear. So many do. We ride in silence for a while, and I don't know about Arlene, but it's nice to sit that close to someone and not feel the incessant need to talk. The two of us could just be, which is what I need right now. Because I am Mary Iris Malone, and I am not okay. Chapter 4. Abilitol. I began my sessions with Dr. Wilson just over a year ago. His many framed degrees assured everyone that he was an actual doctor and not, as I feared, a professional clown.
Tell me what you see here, Mary.
That's not my name, Doc, or didn't my parents tell you? The doctor's lips curled into a coy smile.
I'm sorry, Mim. Tell me what...
Wrong again, I whispered. Dr. Wilson looked to my father for help, but that well had dried up long ago.
Okay, then, he said. What is your name?
Antoine, I said, straight-faced. Mim, that's enough, said Dad. Answer Dr. Wilson's questions. Most girls my age had long ago stopped telling the truth and simply started saying what everyone wanted to hear. But sometime during middle school, or maybe even before, I'd made a choice about the kind of kid I was going to be, and more importantly, the kind of kid I wasn't going to be.
Mim, prodded Dr. Wilson, can you tell me what you...
Where's your bear, Doc? I interrupted.
I'm sorry, my what?
Wait, don't tell me you're a bearless doctor. Dr. Wilson furrowed his brow and looked to my father.
Dr. McIndy's waiting room had a...
Dad sighed as if he'd rather say anything other than what he was about to say.
It had a life-sized grizzly. Stuffed. Did it? Said Dr. Wilson.
His smile had a certain juvenile quality I recognized immediately. He thinks he's better than Dr. McIndy. I picked up the ink splotches and leafed through them one by one. Penis, penis, penis. Wow, is that a labia?
Mim, God, please, said Dad.
I slapped the cards down on the desk, then held up both middle fingers. Tell me what you see here, Doc. Dad stood, looked to my mother, who sat quietly with her hands in her lap. She wasn't smiling, but she wasn't frowning either.
It's okay, Mr. Malone, said Dr. Wilson, motioning for him to sit.
Then, turning to me, he said,
Remember what we talked about, Mim. Remember the importance of verbally expressing exactly how you feel. Sometimes a thing doesn't seem real until we say it out loud.
I rolled my eyes. I feel angry and...
Start with your name, interrupted the doctor, holding up his hands. Your full name, please.
I am Mary Iris Malone.
Go on, he whispered.
I lowered my voice because, as I'd learned some time ago, a whisper was louder than a scream. And I am not okay. I'm angry and bored, and I think Dr. McIndie is 100,000 times better at being a doctor than you are.
Wilson's smile was infuriating. And what about the voices, Mim? Have you had any episodes lately?
You make it sound like, I don't know, epilepsy or something. Like I'm drooling and convulsing all day.
I picked up an inkblot card.
And aren't inkblots, like, completely medieval? What's next, a lobotomy? Shock treatment? God, it's like cuckoo's nest in here.
Wilson nodded, unfazed. We can be done with the inkblots if you'd like.
Yes, I'd like, very much, I'd like. Pushing his chair back from his desk, Wilson opened a drawer and pulled out a stereo that looked as if it had been shot from a cannon.
He thumbed through a book of CDs.
How about some music? You like Vivaldi?
McIndie had Elvis.
I'm afraid I only have classical.
Shocker. Fine. Bach, then. Cello Suite Number 1?
He shuffled through the CDs, pulled out a Bach double disc.
I'm fairly certain the first cello concerto is on here.
Sweet, I corrected.
Yes, it is, he mumbled. Very sweet.
Blimey, you're an idiot, Doc.
Dad sank back in his chair, buried his head in his hands. Admittedly, he'd been hanging by a very thin thread, but this seemed to do him in. Dr. Wilson asked a few more questions and jotted down some notes while I studied his office. Cozy plants, cozy chairs, a mahogany desk, no doubt the price of an Audi, and behind the good doctor, his wall of hubris. I counted 7 framed degrees, hung with care and pride and more than a little jackassedness.
Oh ho, you don't believe I'm important, eh? Well then, how do you explain these?
Wilson stopped writing for a second.
Your family has a history of psychosis, I believe.
Dad nodded.
My sister?
A few dramatic underlines later, Wilson closed my file and pulled out a new pad of paper. It was smaller and pink.
I'm going to prescribe aripiprazole, he said. 10 milligrams a day. That's 1 tablet daily.
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Mom grab Dad's leg and squeeze. He shifted, pulled his leg away, said nothing.
I'm sorry, said Mom.
They were the first words she'd spoken since we'd arrived.
Is that really necessary? Dr. McIndie was of the opinion that medication in Mim's case was premature.
Wilson took off his glasses, met my father's eyes briefly, then ripped the prescription from his pad.
I'm afraid Dr. McIndie and I disagree on this matter. It is your choice, of course, but this is my professional recommendation.
I was the only one who caught this dig at McIndie. Or the only one who cared, anyway.
Professional? Insinuating McIndie's recommendation was less than.
As far as I was concerned, Wilson and Dad and their dedication to medication were more absurd than all the stuffed grizzlies in the land.
We read about a drug that was getting good results,
said Dad, looking at the prescription.
What was it called, Evie? Ability something?
Mom crossed her arms and looked the other way. She had a fire in her eyes I hadn't seen before. The doctor nodded.
That's this. Aripiprazole is commonly known as abilitol.
A pall fell over the room. A black shroud of disease and deathbeds and all the worst things from all the worst places. This mutant word, a tragic portmanteau. The unnatural marriage of 2 roots as different could be. And do you, ability, take vitriol to be your lawfully wedded suffix? I wanted to scream objections to the unholy matrimony, but nothing came out. My mouth was clammy and dry, full of sand. Dr. Wilson smiled ever on, rambling about the benefits of abilitol, while my father nodded like a toy bobblehead immune to the deepening shadow in the room. As I spoke, I caught my mother's eye. I could tell by her face she felt the deepening shadow, too. Neither of us smiled. Neither of us spoke. We felt the shadow together. Chapter 5. The Sixth Letter. I wake up to the hum of cross-country travel, the late sun on my face, and Arlene's heavy head on my shoulder. If it weren't for her snoring, I would swear the old gal was either dead or in a coma. Wiping away the thin string of drool dangling from Arlene's mouth to my shoulder, I nudge her head in the opposite direction and pull my backpack into my lap. Prone to unwieldy dreams, I've always found naps to be more exhausting than refreshing, and this one was no exception. I dreamed about a science project from fifth grade. We were given a map of the world and told to cut out each continent, then piece them back together as they were millions of years ago when there weren't seven separate continents, but rather one supercontinent known as Pangaea. In real life, I did just that. But unwieldy dreams care nothing for the wields of life. And instead of cutting out continents in the dream, I decided to cut out the small state of Mississippi. Before I could do so, the page became actual land, and I found myself staring at the entire state from an aerial view. Its tall, box-like shape with those sharp angles, the jutting jaw. At the bottom, a small neck running right into the Gulf of Mexico. Suddenly, Mississippi crumbled before my very eyes and sank into the water. No sooner was it gone than a mighty army of mosquitoes took its place. Millions and millions of them, buzzing aimlessly, digesting hot blood, suspended in midair over the salty water. For a moment, they stayed in the exact shape as Mississippi, so it looked as if the state was still there, only buzzing, flittering about. And then the army, as one, turned toward me. That was when I woke up. Wiping sweat from my forehead, I try to find the breath I lost during the dream. The rolling timpani of the bus engine, the horn section of murmuring passengers, and the occasional rim shot of backfire somehow help. It's a symphony of transportation, a soothing reassurance that I am closer to my mom, farther from mosquito land. I dab at the wet spot on my shoulder, courtesy of Arlene's sleep drool, and unzip my bag. Something about being hunted by blood-sucking devils compels a girl to double-check her resources. Popping the lid off the Hills Brothers coffee can, I count by 20 to 700. The bus ticket cost 180, so I'm... My heart flips over in my chest. What is that? From the bottom of the can, I pull out a thin tube of papers wrapped in a rubber band. My epiglottis flutters out of pure fascination. What secrets might Kathy be keeping in her beloved coffee can? Arlene grunts, opens one eye, scratches the peach fuzz on her chin, then drops her head on my shoulder. I nudge it gently toward the aisle where it lulls for a second before flopping right back where it was. Damn, old broad's persistent. Tucking the cash and coffee can back in my bag, I stuff the papers in my pocket, hold Arlene's head up with one hand, twist around in my seat, and peer down at the cute couple behind us. Whatcha, chaps? For some reason, people listen when you're British, something I've witnessed firsthand from my mother's undyingly cool accent.
I really must get to the loo pronto, yeah? Would you mind terribly if I climbed over into your seats? There's a sweet old lady asleep over here, and I'm finding it rather difficult to get by.
Only I say the word rather like rather. As their mouths curl into a smile, I decide to withdraw the cute couple status, at least as it pertains to their teeth. Seriously, they could use a trip or seven to the orthodontist. And before the guy even speaks, something clicks in my brain.
Where are you from, mate?
asks his ugly teeth.
When your mother is British, you are keenly aware of fake accents in movies and on TV, which is part of the reason mine is so good. It's also the reason I can tell this guy is for sure British.
Oxbridge, I say.
Damn, Mim. London, Cambridge, Oxford, Liverpool, Dover. I've even been to London, twice actually for family reunions, but no. Oxbridge. Ox-effing bridge. Her ugly teeth smiles at his ugly teeth.
Love, don't you have a mate who lives in Oxbridge?
He's holding back a laugh now.
Oh, yeah, well, Nigel used to, love, but he moved down to Bumlicton, remember?
Was it Bumlicton or Luncamden for Bridgeton?
Unfortunately for me, they know a real British accent when they hear one, too. Laughing their monarchical asses off, they shift out of their seats to let me climb over. What with the overhead compartments, it's a tight fit, but I manage. I make my way to the back of the bus, the jeers of the Brits still ringing in my ears, then slip into the closet-sized bathroom and slide the lock to occupied. A tiny mirror hangs above the sink, barely large enough to reflect my face, and for just a moment I consider using the war paint. It's been a while, right? Okay, fine, I just used it last night, but after the breaking news, who could blame me? I stick my hand in my pocket, twist the tube with the little silver ring in the middle, and... patience, Mary. Taking a deep breath, I push the lipstick farther down in my pocket, pull out Kathy's covert papers, and sit on top of the plastic toilet lid. I pull off the rubber band, unroll the papers, and read. The first sheet is a disgusting love letter between Kathy and my dad, something I'd give a kidney to unsee. Half standing, I raise the seat and toss the letter into the toilet. The next six pages are letters, too, but far different from the first, and written in very familiar handwriting. Kathy, in response to your last letter, the answer is no. Additionally, please don't pretend that I won't beat this. How are things at Mary's new school? Tell her father I asked. Eve. Kathy, I don't have a television in my room, which doesn't seem right. Would you mind checking on that for me? No one around here listens. And yes, I understand that it will get harder before it gets better. I'm the one who's sick. Eve. Kathy. These damn people won't listen. Did you call about the TV? E. Kathy. Feeling better. Please talk to Barry about an exit strategy. E. Kathy. Seriously. I'm going to die in here. Please help. E. The sixth and final letter is a haphazard scrawl, without salutation or signature. I read it at least a dozen times. Think of what's best for her. Please reconsider. Every ounce of Mim blood rushes to my head, wraps its tiny little platelets around my brain and squeezes. I can't breathe. I can't think. I can't. Mom has cancer. Of the breast, lung, liver, it doesn't matter. Or typhoid, maybe. Do people still get that? I'm not sure. She could easily have contracted some deadly bird flu. I mean, they're effing birds. They can get to anybody. But no, that's silly. Or maybe not silly, but newsworthy. I'd know about it, at least. No, cancer is the most likely suspect. People get cancer all the time. But why ask Kathy, of all people, for help? My right hand, almost without my knowledge, squeezes into a fist, crumpling the first five letters into a tight snowball. I stand and raise the plastic lid. The love letter has sunk to the bottom, a metaphor worth its weight in gold. I toss the epistolary snowball in after it and push the handle to flush. Turning to the mirror, I wipe away the grime and stare at my reflection. It's anemic, like a stick figure. Fucking Kathy. Before Mom's line had been disconnected, I used to call once a day. Kathy said maybe that wasn't such a good idea. She said I should give my mother some space, like we were talking about a cute boy or something. In my hand, the last letter feels like a bullet. And suddenly, a new idea occurs to me. What if these aren't the only letters Kathy's been hiding? Mom left 3 months ago. For the first 2 months plus, I received a letter a week. Then 3 weeks ago, the letters stopped. But what if they didn't? Kathy had made it abundantly clear she didn't want me calling Mom, so why would she be okay with letters? Was there another hidden coffee can somewhere with 3 weeks' worth of correspondence from Mom? I open my fist, reread the bullet. Think of what's best for her. Please reconsider. Mom is talking about me. And what's best for me is to be with her. But Kathy doesn't want me to call Mom, and she doesn't want me to write Mom. Of course she wouldn't want me to see Mom. A new hate is stirring low, a chasmic, fiery loathing. I stuff the sixth letter in my pocket, pull out my war paint. Normally, this is a sacred process, requiring no small amount of finesse. But right now, my finesse level is hovering somewhere around Velociraptor. I am finesseless. I have no finesse. Just before the lipstick meets the sallow skin of my cheek, the toilet behind me gives a low belch. Somewhere below my feet, there's a rumbling gurgle, and for the first time I see the sign under the mirror. Use trash can for paper towels and feminine products. Do not flush. Suck a duck. The sound of rushing fluids comes from somewhere behind the toilet, and I know what's next. First things first, my shoes. I tuck away the lipstick and hop up onto the sink just as rusty-looking fluids begin to trickle over the plastic rim of the toilet. From my improbable nest, I watch in horror as the fluids spread across the floor. Having never given two thoughts to the inner workings of a bus's sewage system, I'm left to imagine some giant stomach-like tank in the bowels of the vehicle boiling to its fill, an impending eruption triggered by the crumpled letters. One thing's for sure, it's starting to stink like whoa. I scan the tiny cabin for something to fix this, anything to put a stopper on the seeping toilet, an emergency anti-flood lever, or a hydraulic vacuum, or some sort of ejection button to catapult me from the bus. But there are no levers, vacuums, or ejection buttons. There is only retreat. From the safety of my sink seat, I reach across the room and slide the lock to unoccupied. By swinging my legs side to side, I'm able to gain enough momentum to get a decent hop off the sink, through the doorway, and into the aisle. It's not a pretty landing, but my shoes remain unsoiled, and that's something. I throw on my best, who, me? Smile, close the door, and make my way back to my row. "Everything come out all right, dearie?" asks Arlene. I smile like, who, me? Slide across her legs and drop into my seat. Less than 30 seconds later, a loud commotion emerges from the back of the bus. Peering over my seat back, I see people wrinkling noses and waving hands in front of faces. A few are laughing, but it's shock and awe laughter, not ha-ha, how funny laughter. Looking down, I see the Brits staring at me with their shirts pulled up over their noses, gas mask style. So that's the way it's gonna be. I'm on a bus full of smartasses. I fall back into my seat, look out the window with my good eye, and can't help but smile a little. For the first time in a long time, I'm right where I belong. Yallabusha County, Mississippi. 818 miles to go. Chapter 6. Sometimes you need a thing. September 1. Late afternoon. Dear Isabel, I am a collection of oddities, a circus of neurons and electrons. My heart is the ringmaster, my soul is the trapeze artist, and the world is my audience. It sounds strange because it is, and it is because I am strange. My misplaced epiglottis is reason number 3. About a year ago, my mother took me to the hospital because I kept throwing up. After running a few tests, the pediatrician told us that my epiglottis was displaced. An uncommon issue, but certainly nothing to lose sleep over. The thing is, when he said displaced, I thought he'd said misplaced, which hit me right on the funny bone. I pictured an absent-minded creator scratching his head and turning the universe upside down in search of Mim's misplaced epiglottis. The doctor prescribed something, but my infantile esophagus persisted with savage tenacity. More often than not, I have no control over where and when I throw up, but on rare occasions I've been able to force the issue. Twice since the move, Dad and Kathy have left me home alone, and both times I've helped myself to their bedroom. I stood on that horrible Berber carpet and observed their desks bumped up next to each other. A PC for the aspiring political blogger, a Mac for the aspiring romance novelist, two desk lamps, one unmade bed, two nightstands, one on either side, both with books and tissues. Half of these things I recognized, half were foreign. And yet there they were, mixed together as one, the familiar with the unfamiliar, the family with the unfamily. That was usually when I threw up, on Kathy's side of the bed. The amount of sanitizer she's gone through, you'd think she was cleaning a gorilla cage. But as I stated at the beginning of this entry, I am a collection of oddities, and one oddity doth not a collection make. The great blinding eclipse is reason number four. A couple years ago, there was a solar eclipse. All the teachers and parents were like, "Whatever you do, don't look directly at the eclipse." I mean, really, they were just going ape over it. Well, me being the kind of girl I am, I half heard what they said, half thought about it, half processed the information, and half obeyed it. I closed one eye and looked directly at the eclipse with the other. Now, I'm half blind. After the initial freakout, I did what any rational person would do upon discovering a mystery ailment. I went online. Online gave my condition a name. Solar retinopathy. A cause. What happens from looking directly into the sun for too long. And a time frame. Usually it doesn't last more than 2 months. As I mentioned before, this happened a couple years ago, so I suppose I've made peace with the potential permanency of my condition. I just realize this paragraph is riddled with parentheses. I suppose I'm just feeling parenthetically inclined right now. Anyway. So why do I mention all this? Why are my medical mysteries reasons? I'm glad you asked. I've developed a theory I like to call the pain principle. The gist of it is this. Pain makes people who they are. Look around, Iz. The generics are everywhere. Shiny people with shinier cars, driving fast, talking faster. They use big words to tell fabulous stories in exotic settings. Take this kid at my school, Dustin somebody or other. He talks all the time about his family's estate. Not house, fucking estate. His mother hired a butler slash chef named Jean-Claude, who, according to Dustin, gives the entire somebody or other family jujitsu lessons every morning at sunrise. Followed by pancakes. Dustin never forgets to mention the pancakes. Now, it would be easy for me to look at Dustin and think, "God, what an interesting life! How I wish it were my own! Woe unto me!" But there's a quality behind Dustin's eyes when he talks. A dimness, like the slow fade of a dying flashlight. Like someone forgot to replace the batteries in Dustin's face. This kind of emptiness can only be filled with heartache and struggle and I don't know what. The enormity of things. The shit stink of life. And neither enormity nor shit stink can be found in a pancake breakfast. Pain is what matters. Not fast cars or big words or fabulous stories in exotic settings. And certainly not some French-toasted sunrise sensei servant motherfucker. I guess what I'm saying is, I've learned to accept my pain as a friend, whatever form it takes. Because I know it's the only thing between me and the most pitiful of all species, the generics. One last thing about being half-blind, because I'm starting to get on my own nerves about the whole mess. I've never told anyone. Signing off, Mary Iris Malone, The Cycloptic Wonder. Arlene, with her wooden box and assorted bouquet of early bird aroma,